Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello everyone, welcome to Dan Snow's History. Have I got a treat for you this time? I've got Stephen Taylor on the podcast. He's a writer that I've long enjoyed reading. He's written wonderful books about naval history in the long 18th century. And you know me, I'm a bit of a sucker for that. His latest book is on the common sailors, the experience of the sailors, the men before the mast. Not the officers, but the men at the sharp end. And rather than being the sort of illiterate, brutally punished, press-ganged, anonymous group of people that we might, the myth tells us they are, actually Stephen has found a rich set of historical sources to tell the story of these sailors. We had a great chat. If you want to watch maritime history, please head over to historyhit.tv. It's a new digital history channel. It is going crazy at the moment, which is really exciting. We've got lots of commissions underway, lots of exciting things, lots of exciting bits of history that we are looking into. You can get a History Hit TV. You can watch the whole thing if you want for just £1, euro, or dollar. If you use the code POD1, P-O-D-1, just enter it in, you get the first month for free, and then they get the second month for just £1, euro, or dollar. It's pretty sweet. We've got a new documentary about Stonehenge up there, including the latest research, exciting stuff. You've got to check that out. And we've also got a new young historian, Luke Pepera. He's talking about Africa and how it's largely been written out of British history. So please, please go and check all those new films out. It's really, really exciting. If you want to get a face covering, if you want to cover your face, because you should around the world stop the spread of COVID, please go to historyhit.com/shop to buy your historical face covering. You're going to absolutely love them. My favourite so far is the jawline of Abraham Lincoln. Go and check that out. In the meantime, everyone, here is Stephen Taylor. Enjoy.
Stephen, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure indeed.
Well, it's my pleasure because I love talking about this period and sailors in this period. But what is the myth that you think that you're grappling with about the men who sailed in these ships?
I think it's the widespread perception that has been bequeathed to us by variety of histories that this was a terrible, frightening, and a suffering way of life. That these were men who were invariably press ganged. Images of the press gang are absolutely typical of the period, usually cudgel wielding brutes tearing some forlorn figure from his family. And it's true, of course, that press gangs were an ugly fact of naval policy in wartime. But many men actually went to sea voluntarily. And if we examine the history, the records, and the voices of these men themselves, they are not the put-upon sufferers that we associate with the common seamen. They are, in fact, a proud and, it must be said, triumphant tribe. Because essentially we come back to the point, I think, repeatedly, and it's not just a matter of naval history, although that's absolutely key to British turning Britain into the superpower of the age, as it were. But there's so many other aspects of the seafaring economy that transformed Britain. There was trade, there was discovery, there was navigation and charting. And I think sometimes these are overlooked in the sort of general focus on war. So we've got Cook's voyages to the South Seas. We've got the East India Company's business in India and China. And ultimately, of course, the voyages of the Enlightenment with Darwin and the Beagle. And all are absolutely dependent upon this individual, the common seaman, Jack Tar, as we generally know him.
Is it possible to make a judgment about what proportion would have volunteered or you know, been willing to go to sea? And what, because there was some press ganging, wasn't there?
Oh, absolutely. And never more so than at times of war, because you've got these huge paradoxes between at the times of peace, when really there is no need for the Navy to be having a large a crew at hand, which accounts for the fact that there wasn't a standing force of naval crewmen. And once a conflict broke out, those men who had been serving and earning quite handsome wages generally on sometimes on the coastal trade, but more specifically on the East India Company's business in India, they would suddenly be at times of war be dragged off ships and forced, of course, to serve in the Navy for lower wages and all the things that went with naval service. But I think one really does need to retain the sense of a kind of independence that these men had. Essentially, you know, they may be press ganged, but if they didn't like a ship and if they didn't like where they found themselves, they could desert. And they very often did. And of course, that was a dangerous business. But at the same time, they very often got away with it, because if there was a need for seamen, as so often there was, they would find themselves in another port and they would find themselves another captain. And the captain, because of the need in finding these kind of these skilled men, because their skills were great, and we can discuss that at some length, were always in demand. I think as well, you know, if we go back to the sense of, you know, the serving in the Navy, it was a tough business. There was flogging, and flogging was obviously a process of suffering in itself. But this was, after all, a time when sailing was booming. Agriculture was in decline, and a man who learnt the ropes as a sailor, he acquired a skill that was almost always in demand. And at the same time, he had a place to sleep. He was provided with food, and one might add, he was also provided with large quantities of drink. So, you know, he knows that this is a tough life, but he finds himself in a group with whom he forms a bond. There is a brotherhood, and one, we might say this is a somewhat romantic notion, but actually I think the record speaks, if you look at not only the success of so many of the aspects of British seafaring, which was really covering the world at that time, you only have to look at the records of British ships in battle against whoever it was. So whatever form of seafaring we're talking about, these men had an absolute conviction that what they were doing well.
And also, you don't want to, you don't want lots of landlubbers. You don't want to just grab any old person off the street, do you? You need people that know how to sail. I mean, these are highly sophisticated pieces of machinery that you're sailing around the world.
Absolutely. So there's a tier. You know, we get the chap who comes on as a landsman. Now, he is the most junior seaman. But in the process of, as it were, pulling on ropes and helping his crewmen, he learns a series of skills which culminate in his rise from the lowest tier to an ordinary seaman and ultimately to the able seaman, a man who is, in fact, esteemed by his fellows, is valued by his officers, simply because he is absolutely key when it comes to that extraordinary business of going up into the tops. I think this is possibly an experience of which you have some experience yourself, Dan. And actually finding yourself up there at the, you know, 100 feet above a swaying deck, your feet on ropes and swaying between 60 degrees on either side, but all the time looking upon onto this extraordinary, magnificent scene that is this element, which is your world, and which, in a way, works into the kind of poetic side that one sees emerging through seamen's stories, through their writings. I think we have another misconception that these men because they were common folk of their time, could not possibly be literate. In fact, we have got a number of records, 12 absolutely key memoirs, journals, published, unpublished, and another 10, 15 lesser journals, but still also filling in some of those gaps. And here is the seaman as a storyteller who senses there is something very special about his world. He doesn't really feel very much in common with the other commoners of his home soil. So he comes back from exotic parts of the world. Not invariably exotic, but he might have been to the South Seas, he might have been to China, he might have been to India. And he comes back with these extraordinary stories, his experiences, encounters, strange creatures. There are a range of stories which you can which come back in this process and which are spelt out in these memoirs. Some of them quite romantic encounters with women in the South Seas, for example, island women renowned for their beauty. There's a particularly interesting example of a seaman who was serving on the ships which were taking convicts to New South Wales, and a very romantic story attaches to that, which we can discuss if you like.
Yeah, well, tell us some of these stories, because I think that what are these sources? Were they written for the consumer market? Published sources? Are they private diaries? Where are you finding these accounts?
Well, I think they're two particularly interesting characters. There was a period after the, if you like, sort of the Great Age of Sail, which culminates, of course, in the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, when there was a recognition that the seamen had played a key part in these great victories, the things that are celebrated in the Maritime Museum at Greenwich, you know, all these wonderful canvases of epauletted officers, gold epauletted officers, and their magnificent ships sailing along under sail in storms or in battle. But there was also a story to be told by those who had obviously served in these ships. So there was a small-scale publishing industry. We can take, for example, one of those individuals, a man named John Nicol, a very interesting Scot, a thoughtful romantic, you might say. And he was actually taken to sea by reading Robinson Crusoe, slightly odd one might think, you know, why go to sea in order to become a castaway? But there was that open door to adventure that these stories opened up to men like Nicol. And he then spent decades on naval and merchant ships. He was the guns at the Battle of the Nile. He was also just a natural adventurer who wanted to visit exotic parts of the world and who was exhilarated by the experiences he had of visiting China and the South Seas. He was also, and this is quite an interesting aspect of what I would see as Jack's character, he was quite unworldly. He was on the Lady Juliana, one of the ships transporting convicts to New South Wales, and fell completely in love with one of the female prisoners. Now, there was quite a lot of actually what might be say sexual experiences between the convicts and the seamen on these ships. So far as John Nicol was concerned, this was the love of his life. She, in fact, Sarah, bore him a child by the time that they landed in New South Wales. And although he might have been moved by this experience to desert, he was a very loyal man on his ship, so he sailed on, but always came back with the intention of finding Sarah. And he did actually spend years on a quest, sailing to India, sailing back to New South Wales, only to discover that she had, as one might say, as many seamen had, an instinct for survival. She needed an instinct for survival, and she found another man who could help to support her. So We've got men like Nicol on the one hand, as they say, romantic, somewhat unworldly, and yet on the other hand, another journal kept by another seaman reflects a different aspect of Jack's character. So whereas Nicol was a Scot, a man named Jacob Nagel was an American who actually fought for his country's independence before he decided that the Royal Navy was a perfectly good place for him to serve. And he then spent decades sailing with British ships of all kinds. And, you know, he's a complete rumbustious character. You know, he's quick with his fists. He loves a night out when he's full pay with his shipmates when they come to shore. His relationship with women are generally, as is the case with so many seamen, a commercial kind, but he's generous, thoughtful. He understands that they've got their difficulties too, the lasses who are working in Portsmouth, the Portsmouth Poles. He always treats them with generosity. And if we study these, let's just take these two journals. You read these stories and you might be inclined to say, this is a good story, but is it possibly true? Because they do tell extraordinary tales, cast away, being cast away, shipwreck and all the other things. And yet if you go to the maritime records at Kew, the National Archives, and you study the ship's logs, the ship's musters, which record all the crew who were on a ship at a particular time, and you match those with these individuals who've left their memoirs subsequently to be published, you find that they match. There you will find on that ship's muster, Jacob Nagel, or in the case of John Nicol, and all the others whose memoirs, journals, published or not, who I drew upon for the source. If I would just give one particular interesting case in point, just again to emphasize the variety of individuals who came onto ships. There's after an old hand named James Choice died at a lodging house in Brighton in 1836, it was found that he had kept a journal. And although it's written in a rather wooden style, it does tell another astonishing story, how he was taken off a prisoner off a whaler in Peru while he was little more than a boy. How he survived at the very edge in South America, made various escape attempts, had a brief career as a pirate, and then another spell in captivity, this time in France. And at that point, he writes in his journal, "I disowned the name of an Englishman, as it had always been so unlucky to me, and joined the enemy, reasoning, who would not fight for so good a master as Bonaparte?" Well, he then writes of how, and this is while he's still serving with the French, on sighting a British squadron at anchor off Brittany, he stole a boat and rowed out to a ship called the Theseus. Now, at this point, you say, this is pushing it a bit too far. This must be a fantasy. But if you go to the log of the Theseus, there it is entered, and it confirms that a man named James Choice had been welcomed up the side, as he explained, after escaping from a French prisoner. So again, one finds that these sort of hair-raising and extraordinary stories actually fit so often into the records, which spread the wider picture, if you like.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I'm looking for answers to the big questions about every aspect of life in the early modern period. Like, how did the memory of Anne Boleyn continue to influence the court of her daughter, Elizabeth I? How were fairies brought to life on the Elizabethan stage? And how did the arrival of male-only doctors threaten the lives of women? In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Subscribe now and follow me on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when using messaging apps, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage. Add unlimited photos and videos and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's auraframes.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. Sea battles were rare, but they sounded extremely dangerous. Terrifying to be on board a wooden ship as giant cannonballs and smashing through great planks of oak and spreading, sending splinters somersaulting through the air.
Yes, I think clearly the wounds that were inflicted in these kind of circumstances, very often not by cannonballs themselves directly, but by the splinters that they generated as they exploded coming through a side or hitting some part of the ship. The wounds that were taken in these kind of in these circumstances were, as you say, very horrifying. There's a lot of kind of the telling of these stories quite often has a head-off variety. You know, you'll hear about so-and-so, and he was standing beside me and his head disappeared. I think that becomes a bit of a, if you like, a disguise for the really rather terrible wounds that could be inflicted on these occasions. And there was at the same time, in the intensity of this battle, a confusion, because very often the men were very unable to see much more than the powder at hand, the ball that had to be loaded, and the cannon that they were serving upon. So it was an intense but relatively brief affair, as it was seen by, for example, those military men, army officers who had some experience of seeing naval battles, actually thought, well, I wouldn't mind having a part in that because it's bloody, but it's brief. And that was, I think, the sense that that the intensity that British sailors brought to that activity, the speed that they were with which they were able to load a cannon and fire it, and the accuracy which they did, was so crucial to the success. Not so much of, well, tactics were clearly important, but it was actually the effectiveness of the British ship in battle that was so key. And there is quite an interesting little extract, which I might read if you like, because it comes from a French officer who was at Trafalgar, and he surrendered and found, of course, that on surrendering his ship, a British crew came on board to take control. And as we know, Trafalgar, the battle itself, was followed by the most furious storm. And as he described it, they, the British seamen, immediately set to work to shorten sail and reef in topsails with as much regularity and order as if their ships had not been fighting a dreadful battle. We were all amazement, wondering what the English sailor could be made of. All our seamen were drunk or disabled.
Yeah, and I'm reminded after the Battle of the Saints at the end of the American War of Independence, when the French commander just says the British are 100 years ahead of us. It's remarkable. You wouldn't want to be fighting against the Royal Navy in this period. What about meritocracy? Captain Cook obviously joins as an ordinary seaman and rises up through the ranks. I think Admiral Sanders does at Quebec. He was a former common seaman. Are you more likely to be promoted and grow wealthy that if you're from a humble background than their equivalents in the army?
I think there was something about the nature of naval life, if we're talking about, and we are clearly talking about the Navy, but the nature of life on board, where, of course, we're talking about a very limited space, which created a degree of intimacy between the officer class and the lower deck. I mean, you couldn't, on a space which was no more than 50 metres by about 12, 13 metres, sustain a huge social difference, as you did, for example, on the landed class between the landowner and his commoner labourers. And because perhaps of that sense that there was a community here working together, there was a greater degree of rising from the lower deck. Not very widespread, but you mentioned those examples. There's another very interesting example of, indeed, one of the most famous of our commanders, Edward Pellew, who was, he was a Cornish boy, grew up by the seaside, just immediately, because this was his world, drawn to the sea. And probably because of his initiative, his strength, his skill, and his robustness of character attracted attention in a way that would have did bring him the kind of sponsorship that rose him into an officer level at a fairly early stage in his life. I think he was promoted to lieutenant when he was about 21. Because he didn't have the kind of sponsorship, the kind of, as it was said, influence that was generally required to go all the way to the top, he was then set aside. And it took a series of extraordinary fortunate events for him, and the eagerness and the talent with which he seized those opportunities, to become, first of all, probably, in my view, the most successful frigate captain of that era. And ultimately, because of that, and because he did actually have huge abilities, despite the fact that he would generally spoil his influence at Westminster sooner or later, and quite regularly did, he still rose to the level of admiral.
And then lastly, were they pensioned off? How did the story end for most of them? Did they die of old age and hardship on board, or did they have successful afterlives?
Well, I suppose there are many answers to that particular aspect of their story as there are individuals themselves. I mean, yes, a great number ended up in severe difficulties. Take, for example, John Nicol, who I mentioned earlier, the romantic seaman of that particular period, the great adventurous wanderer. He was actually found scrabbling on the streets of Edinburgh, looking for coals to keep himself warm by, in effect, a local journalist who recognised that here was a man who had an extraordinary story to tell. It didn't greatly help Nicol, but it removed him from that degree of poverty. Jacob Nagel also ended up in severe shortage. At the same time, we must remember that one of the great institutions which was founded by the Navy at the time was the Pensioners' Refuge at Greenwich. It was always said that those who were fortunate enough to end up in that old, wonderful, what was called the Naval Hospital, was safe moored in Greenwich Pier. And you had to have a certain series of, you had to have a period of service that would entitle you to a place there. It wasn't always easy to obtain that. You had to report to a series of boards and present your documents. And if you didn't have that documents, those documents, and you weren't able to prove your, as it were, your service, you would be discarded. But those who did find themselves in Greenwich could not have been more, as it were, favoured. And they became a kind of a visitor centre for people who became interested in the maritime past. They would go down to Greenwich and they would speak to these old pensioners, ask them to spin their stories. One of those who they might have found down there, very interesting character as well, is a man named Tom Allen. Now, actually, if you go to Greenwich, there at the Maritime Museum, among all the wonderful canvases all around, tucked away on a side wall is a painting, a portrait of Tom Allen. And Tom owes his place in history to a particular association. He actually started out as a ploughman in Norfolk until he was spotted by a local family. The family's name was Nelson. The individual who spotted him was named Horatio. And Horatio Nelson at that time was a relatively junior captain, but he needed crew. And so often these local resources provided a kind of, if you like, supply chain. It was a very effective supply chain because these were men who shared a community, they shared a background. And so Tom Allen, having been taken on board by Nelson, then just a captain, became his servant and stayed with him for years, would accompany him into the great cabin for dinners, actually had a degree of informal relationship with Nelson that somewhat astonished visitors, because he would be telling Nelson that he'd had enough wine and it was time for him to retire. He actually overstepped the mark in the end. But he, because of his long service, was one of those who did end up at Greenwich and who would be spinning his yarns, his years of service under the great man, to anybody interested to come down to Greenwich and ask those kind of questions.
He would certainly have been allowed on the podcast, I'll tell you that much. Thank you so much. Your book is called?
Sons of the Waves, The Common Man at Sea in the Heroic Age of Sail.
Brilliant. Well, good luck with it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan. Good luck to you.
I feel the hand of history upon our shoulders.
All this tradition of ours, our school history, our songs, this part of the history of our country, all were gone and finished and liquidated.
One child, one teacher, one book, and one pen can change the world.
He tells us what is possible, not just in the pages of history books, but in our own lives as well.
I have faith in you.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.